Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
8 years on, the war in Afghanistan continues. Tonight, President Obama offered his plan to bring it to an end. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Tuesday. It is the 1st of December today. The broad outlines of the president's Afghanistan speech tonight have been generally known, troop levels and a basic timetable. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is covering the speech for us. He's here with more. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
30,000 troops, as the president said, John. $30 billion, as he also said. Where's he going to get the money?
Well, it's going to have to be tacked on to the overall cost of the war, which is already $120 billion this year. Much of it is borrowed money. There are some congressional opponents of this troop increase who will try to block funding because of that. But Republicans and most moderate Democrats will support the extra spending. Still, you know, you could tell Obama knows there's little public taste for the additional costs of the war.
Years of debate over Iraq and terrorism have left our unity on national security issues in tatters and created a highly polarized and partisan backdrop for this effort. And having just experienced the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the American people are understandably focused on rebuilding our economy and putting people to work here at home.
That $30 billion, John, though, is just direct military spending, right? There is going to be more to add to the tab.
That's right. There's a big effort to train the Afghan army to handle their own security. 5,000 of the 30,000 new U.S. troops are trainers for the Afghan army. There's also a program to appeal to the hearts and minds of local citizens, job creation, infrastructure projects, to keep the Afghan people from gravitating to the Taliban. Plus, there's more help for Pakistani troops next door to keep Taliban insurgents from attacking in Afghanistan and then running across the border to hide. Lawrence Korb, who dealt with defense budgets as a Pentagon official in the Reagan administration, says the extra troops will create a lot of extra expenses.
You've got to have facilities. You're going to have contractors there that are going to feed them and you know, do the repairs. And a lot of times when we've had these surges, they haven't counted completely all the support troops that you need.
On the topic of costs, John, Representative David Obie from Wisconsin chairs the House Appropriations Committee. He has been talking about a tax, a war tax, to pay for this. Is that going to go anywhere?
You know, it doesn't really have much of a chance for several reasons, not least of which is the fragile economy. And there's another idea to tack on an extra gasoline tax. That would also be a tough sell, especially if gasoline prices go up. Supporters of these taxes say, you know, the rest of the country beyond the military should be contributing to the war to spread the sacrifice. But taxes are definitely not popular with lawmakers who are headed for a re-election in less than a year.
John Dimsdale on the president's Afghanistan speech tonight. Thank you, John.
My pleasure.
The president did mention the economy briefly this evening, and there is some news on that score. Last month, the White House claimed its stimulus plan had created or saved almost 640,000 jobs. That number was met with a whole lot of head scratching, here included. But today, the Congressional Budget Office said the administration's guess might have been too low, that the stimulus helped save anywhere from 600,000 to 1.5 million jobs. Thing is, that stimulus money is eventually going to go away. So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, what happens then?
A chunk of the stimulus cash went toward creating construction jobs. Thousands of workers were hired for infrastructure projects, things like highway and bridge repair. What'll happen to those workers when the government's stimulus money runs out? Their jobs will run out, too. Ken Simonson is chief economist at the Associated General Contractors of America, a trade group in Washington.
3/4 of construction firms, highway construction firms, expect to have to lay off people next year.
And they're not the only ones. A lot of states use the stimulus money to avoid laying off teachers and other government workers. Joel Neroff is president of Neroff Economic Advisors.
State governments that use the money to retain a lot of their workers, they're going to be facing a crisis as you get to the next fiscal year starting next summer.
But problems could start sooner than that. Only about a third of the $787 billion in stimulus money has been spent so far. But economist Carrie Leahy of Decision Economics says the money will run out in March.
If the private job creation machine doesn't get sparked up by then, there won't be much to replace the lost stimulus, and people are worried about a very sluggish and disappointing job market.
The unemployment rate is expected to hover in the 10% range at least for the first half of next year. It was at 10.2% in October. We'll get November's jobless figures this Friday. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler all posted November sales numbers this morning that were better than expected. That suggests Americans are in a car-buying mood again because those sales had nothing to do with cash for clunkers. But if that program did help unblock one part of the car business, it has done gone and clogged up another one. Recyclers, who were given the job of scrapping all those cars, have more business now than they can handle, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
When cash for clunkers was at full throttle, dealers could hardly keep new cars on their lots. The scrappers had the opposite problem.
We had cars in our parking lot. We had cars on trailers. We had cars everywhere.
Andrew Adlin manages Adlin Brothers Auto Wrecking. It's just north of Los Angeles.
We had cars stacked on top of cars. It was a big mess.
His company buys used cars from dealers. They sell whatever parts they can to the public. They crush the rest and sell it for scrap. Things have settled down a bit for Adlin Brothers, but they still have a salvage yard full of clunkers that have to be processed in the next few months. Adlin says if they don't get more time, they'll lose money because they'll have to crush the cars before they can sell the parts. Michael Wilson is with the Automotive Recyclers Association. He says processing all those clunkers at once could distort the market for parts and for scrap metal.
All this metal going through the marketplace at, you know, within a 2 or 4 week time period, that could adversely affect the markets, having a glut of that metal coming through all at one time.
It's not just the market, though. It's jobs. Andrew Adlin says thanks to cash for clunkers, he hired 20 more people. If the deadline isn't extended, he might have to lay people off.
Being able to process the cars at our pace might actually extend the amount that we can keep employees and the amount of parts sales. You know, it would extend everything.
The Transportation Department is expected to make a decision on the rule by February 1st, which is also the deadline for the first clunkers to be scrapped. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Worries about Dubai were far, far away from Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the number. A lot of people out there would probably love to have a house right on the beach someplace, unrestricted access to the surf and the sand. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court is going to take up a case that is mostly about that sand, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Owning a house on the beach is a beautiful thing, but in most parts of the country, it's also a big risk. That's because your property line is tied to the water line, which shifts naturally.
When you buy a home on the water, you sometimes get a little, you sometimes lose a little, and that's why that's sort of a dynamic boundary.
Julia Wyman is a lawyer representing coastal states. She says in many places, if a storm washes away your front yard, c'est la vie. Florida is a bit different. There, the state can set a so-called erosion control line at the high tide mark.
It's a fixed line in the sand, if you will.
Above that line is private property. Below it is a public beach, and it's that line in the sand that's led to this Supreme Court case. Every year, Florida officials dump tons of sand along miles of coastline to preserve the state's top tourism draw, its beaches. But the program also creates strips of new public beach. Elias Shapiro is an attorney at the Cato Institute. He says that's a problem.
It has the potential of converting people's beachfront property into beachview property, and that's definitely a difference.
Meaning a beachfront house isn't really on the water anymore, and instead looks out on a public beach open to anyone. So 6 years ago, a half dozen homeowners in Walton County, Florida, sued to stop the state and local authorities from creating new public beach land between their homes and the Gulf of Mexico. They argued the state was taking away their exclusive access to the water without compensation. The Florida Supreme Court disagreed. Lawyer Doug Kendall filed a brief in support of state authorities.
What the state has done here, it provides an enormous benefit to these property owners by guaranteeing, notwithstanding any hurricanes or erosion that nature may bring, that we will rebuild the beach in front of your property and spend millions of dollars to do so.
If the Supreme Court sides with homeowners, Julia Wyman, the lawyer for Coastal States, said it would force Florida to pay waterfront property owners whenever new public beaches are created.
It would, I'm sure, add a layer of cost, certainly.
And it could tie the state's hands at a time when climate is changing, and she fears more intense storms and rising sea levels.
We're going to be constantly facing these new threats, and that allowing the states to best deal with these threats really is in the best interests of the nation as a whole.
Wyman says states should be allowed to protect the coasts, and federal courts should stay out of it. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
President Obama is hosting a big jobs summit at the White House Thursday. Nobody really expects the meeting to come up with an actual plan to fix the labor market. But just in case, one of the president's top economic advisors is doing his bit to lower expectations. Larry Summers said this week bringing the unemployment rate down from 10.2% is going to take some time. In Germany, the recession has been almost as bad as it has been here, and the jobless rate is almost as high, about 8%. But overall, workers in Europe's biggest economy have largely dodged the bullet. Marketplace's Amy Scott explains how.
At the MAN truck assembly plant in Munich, workers attach wheels onto an axle. An electronic sign overhead tells them how many trucks they have to build that day. Union official Klaus Brinig says that number has changed in the last year.
In normal time, we have 160 trucks, and now 47.
Workers are building fewer trucks because demand has dropped in half this year. But MAN says it hasn't had to lay off any of its permanent staff. That's because it's signed up for a government program called Kurzarbeit, or short work. Workers take a cut in their hours and their pay, but the German government reimburses them for a chunk of their lost wages. MAN spokesman Dominique Nadelhofer says employees may work as little as half-time, but they still make 90% of their salary.
For us, it's a good tool, actually, to keep them on the payroll, to have them on board. And if the demand picks up again, then we don't need to hire new people.
He says workers get to hold on to their jobs and have some free time for training or hobbies.
I've had a quite fun example, actually, of one guy who is raising parrots. And he told me that he has more than 50 parrots, actually, and that now he has more time to spend with his parrots.
Kurzarbeit has given an estimated 1.5 million German workers more time for their hobbies. Economists say it's also saved hundreds of thousands of jobs. It hasn't been cheap. The government will pay out an estimated $16 billion this year. Some might see it as crazy to keep paying a part of so many people's salaries. But economist Stefan Schneider with Deutsche Bank says it makes sense.
The argument is, and I think that's the correct one, that if these people were unemployed, it would be even more expensive for the government.
Analysts say Kurzarbeit is one reason consumer spending in Germany has held up. But it's not clear how long the government can prop up the labor market. Right now, companies can tap the program for up to 2 years, though there's some talk of extending it if the economy doesn't bounce back quickly. Some economists worry Kurzarbeit may just postpone the inevitable by keeping manufacturers from making some hard choices. Eckhart Tuchfeld is with Commerzbank.
If production is scaled down so sharply as we have recently experienced, there must be some restructuring in the economy.
Restructuring means layoffs. As economic reality sets in, analysts expect unemployment to rise in Germany to 9 or 10% next year. The MAN factory is in full swing on the day I visit. But worker Klaus Brinnig says a few days a week, it's a ghost town. He says he's enjoyed the 4 or 5 days a month he's had off, but he says he and others are starting to worry.
In the beginning, people say, okay, it's fine. We have time for the family, time for the mountains, time for the beer garden. But now, it's a long time. And the people think, was passiert in future?
What happens in the future? After this fall's elections, Germany has a new government. Brinnig worries the more conservative coalition now in power isn't as friendly to labor, and there may be some pressure to end programs like Kurzarbeit. In Munich, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up, nonprofits taking a for-profit approach.
I really look at what we do as a business, and that you have to look at it as a business. I mean, we're in the business of caring.
But first, let's do the numbers. December is off to a good start. The Dow Industrials pumped up almost 1.25% today. 126 points closed at 10,471. The blue chips did. The Nasdaq put on nearly 1.5%, 31 points, finished at 2,175. The S&P 500 moved ahead 1.2%, 13 points, 1108 at the bell. Financial firms did not go along for that ride. Goldman Sachs was off 1.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase was down 0.67%. Morgan Stanley forfeited 0.2%. Citigroup stepped back about 0.25%. The weaker dollar strengthened commodities-related stocks today. Newmont Mining unearthed a 3.75% gain. Aluminum maker Alcoa shined up 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.28%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. By Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Bank of America, which has begun a 10-year, $1.5 trillion investment in low to moderate income communities. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its eighth and final beige book for the year, summarizing current economic conditions. A House subcommittee on health holds a hearing on the recently updated breast cancer screening recommendations. And it's billed as the world's most famous tree. The Rockefeller Center Christmas tree gets lit tomorrow night for the holidays. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The economy is still mostly stuck. A lot of people are out of jobs, and a lot of them are looking for help. Problem is, a recession can't tell the difference between for-profits and nonprofits. And those not-for-profits, organizations that are mostly designed to help people in need, are being squeezed as well. Best guesses are the hurt's only going to get worse over the next year or so. The silver lining is that people are still finding ways to get in some charity.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
To kick off our philanthropy series this year, consultant Lucy Bernholtz, as she has in the past, she joined us for a chat about the top charity-related buzzwords of the year. 2009, she says, was the year where necessity was the mother of social innovation.
We've got quite a bit of very business-oriented buzzwords for you this year. So the first one will be impact investing.
And what is that?
Well, it's the term of art for what you might think of as the active side of socially responsible investing. So it's people looking to put their financial resources to work for a quantifiable financial, social, and environmental impact. So think of using your philanthropic resources to support affordable housing developments or medical disease research, community loan funds.
So where does that play out in the regular economy? I mean, do these kinds of investments sort of supplant what happens with foundations?
Well, a lot of them are coming from foundations. We can count about $5 billion currently coming from foundations going into these kinds of impact investments. And 2009 saw an awful lot of organizing around that. Here's a prediction for you. In 2010, we will have an impact investing index.
Wow, really?
You bet.
All right. Well, you heard it here first. What about buzzword number two?
If impact investing is about finding new ways to finance social good, the second buzzword is B Corps. And these are about finding a new way to deliver social good.
All right. Explain B Corps.
B Corp is a benefit corporation, and it's a new form. It's being pushed through to become law in states. Right now, it allows a small business, any kind of enterprise, to organize and incorporate a deliberate public benefit right into their chartering documents. You're seeing lots of entrepreneurs saying, wait a second, I want to be able to build a sustainable business that is as committed to producing some kind of public good as it is to producing the financial benefits.
Some examples out there?
Method Cleaning Supplies, Numi Tea, and my own company, Blueprint Research and Design.
Yeah, well, I guess that kind of makes sense, actually. All right, so the last buzzword.
Well, the last one is mergers. Back in 2008, when things really hit the skids, we heard some pretty dire predictions about contraction in the sector, start to see a lot of the nonprofit organizations merge and or go out of business. It's picking up in pockets all over the country as nonprofits, which spent most of 2009 cutting their capacity as close to the bone as they possibly could, and they're going to have to start getting strategic and looking for alliances with other organizations.
Does that translate into less of a footprint in communities by some of these, you know, charitable and philanthropic groups?
Well, hopefully it'll translate into a more efficient footprint. But yes, it's likely that we'll just lose organizations that we were relying on, and we'll have to figure out some new way of making sure that the communities still get served.
Lucy Bernholz, she's the president of Blueprint Research and Design. That's a consulting firm for philanthropic institutions and individuals as well. Lucy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. See you next year.
Lucy had mergers as buzzword number three this year, but the truth is a lot of charities have already had to get together to survive. Today on World AIDS Day, the story of two AIDS support groups that decided to join forces. Not far from Dodger Stadium, here in downtown Los Angeles, two little girls sit outside coloring holiday cards for their mom. Meanwhile, Martha Aldretti walks me through what appears to be a cozy home. It's filled with the regular stuff, comfortable furniture, lots of pictures, and other kinds of knickknacks.
Okay, you just enter our kitchen, and this is Maria Hernandez. She's our
In the bright yellow kitchen, there are some cookies on the counter and what look like the fixings for lunch. The house, Casa Madonna, is the home for women and children living with HIV/AIDS who might otherwise be homeless.
When they come in, sometimes their health is very, very low, you know, and because either they've been in the streets or they come from an abusive environment and stuff like that.
Casa Madonna and four others like it in L.A. County are managed by a group called the Sarah Project. It's been around for about 20 years, giving people affected by HIV/AIDS a safe place to stay. But a couple of years ago, the folks at the Sarah Project noticed the energy just wasn't there anymore. AIDS programs weren't getting the kind of support that they used to. At the same time, across town, another organization was dealing with that same decline. That group, Aid for AIDS, provides direct financial assistance for people living with the disease, maybe helping out with rent or helping to pay utilities. That similarity got Executive Director Terry Goddard thinking merger, a classic case, really, of vertical integration. The Sarah Project gets people on their feet, then Aid for AIDS helps them get under their own roof.
This happened about 2006. It happened before all of the, you know, the economic catastrophe that happened. We saw this as an opportunity to basically strengthen our organizations in an era that, I mean, we're seeing decreased funding. I mean, the state of California just decreased it by $85 million. So this was an opportunity that we couldn't pass up, and it's one of the best things we did.
We all understand how that works in a corporate environment, right? You get a bunch of lawyers and they hash things out. How does that work for community service organizations that can't really afford bunches of lawyers and really want to spend all their resources on helping those in need?
Well, you still need bunches of lawyers. But what you do is you get pro bono attorneys. And so, and we were very blessed to have both organizations had pro bono attorneys that helped us in this process.
There was some resistance. Anytime you cut $280,000 from a nonprofit's budget, toes are going to be stepped on. Never mind the fact that the two groups really could not have had more different beginnings.
Well, it was interesting because 8th Grades came from the gay community in Silver Lake area. Okay, it started in that as a response. And the Sarah Project started from the Los Angeles Archdiocese.
So once the culture shock was over, Goddard set about reorganizing. The clients and contributors, Aid for AIDS and the Sarah Project, are still two distinct companies. Underneath, though, they share back offices, things like administrative support and development staffs, and most of their donations. It wasn't easy. It took 2 years till the merger was done. But Goddard says even nonprofits, maybe especially nonprofits, absolutely have to think about the bottom line.
I really look at what we do as a business. And that you have to look at it as a business. I mean, we're in the business of caring.
Being a better business lets them take better care of their clients. Clients like Christine. Standing in a hallway at Casa Madonna, she wraps one arm around manager Martha Aldretti.
When I was told I was HIV positive, I couldn't believe it. And I just knew that I was going to die. And I was living with somebody, but then they kicked me out.
Now she's got a room and a place to stay, and Aldretti prodding her to get out on her own.
Before I came here, I was just sitting in the house and doing nothing. But she's my buddy. So when I came, she told me, no, you must go to school.
Christine's in computer classes now. Once she's done with her time at the Sarah Project at Casa Madonna, her case file moves over to Aid for AIDS, and the other half of the merged organization steps in. It's the same company, just a different product. Our philanthropy series continues tomorrow with a look at how giving can somehow make for guilt-free shopping.
Marketplace is supported by Meritas, a worldwide alliance of law firms helping business owners and in-house counsel find pre-qualified local legal counsel for over 19 years. Meritas.org. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, Fritz Henderson is going too. GM said today Henderson's days as CEO are done. No official word on whether it was his idea or the company's, but Henderson was not at the press conference where the announcement was made. In his 8 months running the company, Henderson got a lot of praise for making some of the tough decisions that his predecessor Rick Wagner didn't. The White House, by the way, which holds something like 60% of GM shares, said it had nothing to do with the decision. And that is the program called Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow jumped 126 points, 1.2%. The NASDAQ ticked up 31 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, 1.2% there as well. Thanks to Jennifer Collins on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on the broadcast, the who, the where, and the why of foreign aid.
I learned both from my father and a wise old village Chief Haji Ali, you let the people make the decisions.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you decide to join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.